Hi, I'm David Crow, and this is episode 45 of The Infectious Myth. Thank you for being a listener. Please consider supporting the PRN.FM network that hosts this show. If you have a comment during the show, please feel free to call 888-874-4888. Or at any time, you can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or like the show at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. I'd like to receive your comments on the show, positive or negative, particularly suggestions for future guests. And remember that I don't know your listener until I hear from you. And if you tell me why you like the show and how you're getting information about it and send me your mailing address, I will send you a small gift. Some feedback from Esperanza on our Facebook page. I'm listening to the show with Lisa, which is the previous episode, episode 44, and the information on the fluoroquinolone antibiotics. I had no idea that these medications were so deadly. Thanks for keeping us up to date. Today's guest is Wayne Rode, author of the new book, The Vaccine Court, which is about the pseudo-legal court part of the U.S. National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. This is interesting for a number of reasons. It's an admission by a government that heavily promotes vaccination, that vaccines can cause damage to people. But getting compensation through the court is not easy, as we will find out in our discussion. If you want to find more out about this after the show, Wayne's website for his book is thevaccinecourt.com. That's thevaccinecourt, one word, no punctuation. Welcome to the show, Wayne.
Thank you very much for having me, David. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you.
Yeah, well, thank you for the book that you've written. One of the things that I took from your book was you said that as of March 2014, there have been over 15,100 petitions filed with the NVICP, the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Only 3,500 petitions have been awarded compensation. Nearly $2.8 billion has been paid to petitioners and their attorneys, and the balance of the trust fund is somewhere north of $3.4 billion and growing each year. So there's a lot in that one paragraph that we could talk about. For instance, does this mean that there's only been 15,100 Americans injured by vaccines since the court was established?
Not even close. That's just the number of petitions filed. Now, there's a high burden to overcome to actually file a petition. And in my book, I interviewed over 285 families, quite a few of them who were denied compensation, a few that were awarded compensation, but also several that decided not to even file. They were just overcome with too much the responsibilities of taking care of their vaccine-injured family member or child, and they just did not have the wherewithal to file a petition, track down all the medical records, find an attorney that represented them, and then go through the emotional roller coaster for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, maybe up to 10 or even longer period of time. So there's that real high burden
right
there that a lot of families just decide the heck with it. But also there's a very difficult, what we call a statute of limitations. You only have 3 years from the onset of symptoms for any vaccine injury and only 2 years regarding a death case to file. And many people do not recognize that you have a vaccine injury until long after those periods have expired. So therefore, you're barred or you're prohibited from filing for compensation.
And does everybody know about the this? I'd like to have a short name. The NVICP. Does everybody know about this court?
The NVICP. The nickname that is more appropriate, and then its title of the book is The Vaccine Court.
Okay, let's call it that.
Yeah, or NVICP, but one of the big criticisms of this program And it's going back to the very beginnings when it was passed in a law in 1986, but it didn't start and implement until October of 88, with the lack of public awareness that is mandated by statute in the law that the Secretary of HHS must conduct public awareness campaigns to promote the availability of this program. And that has really been coming under fire. Matter of fact, last year, Congress authorized, authorized for the General Accounting Office, which is their investigative, nonpartisan, entity, to inquire into the program. And they released a report in right before Thanksgiving that stated their number one criticism was the Secretary of HHS has failed to promote this program. My investigations of that for the last 3 to 4 years have found that in meetings and other subsequent discussions, the pharmaceutical industry representatives and also the medical community have frowned upon it and actually derailed attempts in the past to promote the program.
Well, I think most, you know, a lot of people around the world, and we're just talking about America here because this is a very American, this program only works in America, but I think a lot of Americans would be surprised to know that there are adverse reactions to vaccines. I mean, maybe deep down they kind of know it, but to put it right in front of them to say, oh, by the way, I'm going to vaccinate your children, and if anything goes wrong, such as paralysis or autism or something like that, then here's a pamphlet that tells you how to claim money for it. Don't sue me. You got to sue the court. I mean, that would seem to spoil the story of doctors that vaccines are so safe that nobody needs to worry about them.
Well, it does lead to the perception by the medical community, doctors, nurses, and others, that vaccines are very safe when we find out that they actually are not. If someone would, you know, spend a little bit of time in what we call the VAERS, which is the adverse reporting system that is managed by the CDC, you'll find out that there's hundreds, if not thousands, of reports of injury and death of all these different vaccines.
Right.
So it's, I projected in an article that I wrote a couple years ago that the tip of the iceberg is what we see in the vaccine court. And every year the trend is coming up, but the last couple of years it's been 550 to 600 petitions filed each year.
Right.
The problem with that is that most of these now are adult petitions. We've moved away from childhood vaccine petition program to adults, and the dominant there is the flu shot.
Right.
So children who have severe injuries are basically being shut out. They're being denied compensation.
So explain how this works. Are you saying that parents are no longer trying to claim compensation, or is the court throwing out more cases?
The court is throwing them out more. What we've noticed is that in 1995, this was the first big step in this, is when the Secretary of HHS removed what they call residual seizure disorder from the known vaccine injury table for the DPT vaccine. That was the vaccine. It was a horrible vaccine that was injuring thousands of children every year and killing several hundred. And that was the main emphasis why you had this whole program, and it was passed by Congress in 1986, is because of the DPT vaccine. But in 1995, the Secretary of HHS at the time was Donna Shalala, under the Clinton administration, reviewed the IOM report and said there is no causation or that we know of that it says is that residual seizure disorder is caused by the DPT vaccine versus other, you know, other events. So she removes that. That right there was the big turning point in the whole program, and it forced thousands of, or several thousand petitions to actually become, instead of being eligible for compensation, now they had to go through the very difficult minefield of proving causation, which means you had to have an attorney that was experienced in these matters. You had to hire very expensive but also very rare medical experts to help prove your case. Well, that started shutting down the access.
Yeah, and let me just try to see if I understand this. So what you're saying is that the court has, for each vaccine, a table of known and recognized injuries. And theoretically, if your injury is on that, and not every vaccine will have the same list, but if you got a particular vaccine and your injury matches this list, then you should get compensation without much of a fuss. But if it's not on the list, then you have to go somehow prove that it should be that you should be compensated, and maybe it would get added to the list, or maybe not.
Correct. But those injuries are being slowly being removed off the table injury. So
right.
Almost since 2009, 90% plus of all petitions are now what we call off-table petitions, meaning you have to go in and prove that you had an injury, and you have to go through the causation. It's a very high burden. It's no longer just, you know, 50% plus a feather. It's a preponderance of evidence and the high standards. And it gets to a point where it's the government saying our medical expert is better than your medical expert,
right.
So we're going to deny the petition. That's not justice. That's not doing anything.
I wanted to ask a question about that. The money for this vaccine compensation program comes from a fee that's attached to every vaccine that's sold in the United States, correct?
That is correct. It's 75 cents for every, what we call, for a flu vaccine, it's 75 cents. The MMR, it's $2.25.
Okay. Now, that money pays whatever compensation is paid out, but a portion of it goes to general revenue, right? Like something like 20%?
25%. And that is in the IRS statute where many of the trust funds that are managed by the federal government, they get to harvest 25% of the revenue and charge it as an administrative fee. So in the IRS statute, and then it was also affirmed by a DHS official in an advisory council meeting several years ago that basically 25% is cut off the top. So instead of 75 cents, it's actually 56 cents.
Right. And is there other money taken out of the system? Like, does all the remaining money, the 75% of the money gathered, does it all go to compensation?
No. By law, HHS and their sub-agencies, which is herself, are allowed to take certain allocations out to reimburse for because they're the primary administrators of the program. Then you have the federal court system through the Federal Court of Claims and Special Masters. They're the ones that adjudicate the program. So the courts get to stick their hand into the cookie jar and take money out.
Right.
And the DOJ, Department of Justice, through the use of their civil attorneys who prosecute the cases on behalf of the government, they also get to take a cut.
So what's left over
is compensation and monies used to pay attorney fees and medical experts.
So let me get this straight, see if I understand this. So if HHS makes the system more and more cumbersome and more complicated. They get to take more money out of the program to pay for more people to make the system more difficult. And then they reduce the number of petitions that get compensation. They reduce the number of people who bother to file because people understand how complicated it is. And then the number of awarded petitions for vaccine injury goes down, and the pharmaceutical companies are happy. The CDC is happy. I mean, what's wrong with this system? It seems to be keeping all the important people happy.
Well, it's keeping everybody happy except for those who are injured or who have died.
Yes, which is a kind of a large number of people. Now, if a child, I don't know if you would know this, but if a child dies, and you know that this is a really complicated system, like if a child is injured, it's you've got a lifetime expense to look after the child. But if the child dies, would people be less likely to try to file compensation because it's going to be really difficult, no guarantee, and their child's gone, so nothing's going to bring their child back?
Well, I've interviewed quite a few families who have had family who've had family members die. Mainly, a
right.
lot of them were children.
Right.
I got into the hepatitis B issue from several years ago, where there was a lot of filings of hepatitis B injuries and death. Then, The next big one was Gardasil, and that became approved in 2007. You started seeing a few petitions filing for injuries, and then a few petitions filed for death. And I actually, in my book, there's a couple different mothers who I've interviewed, and their cases were dismissed because they couldn't prove, because there was not a medical expert that would lay their reputation out on the line and to show that the child died. Now, common sense says yes, because if you administered a vaccine and then 3 days later a healthy girl is taking a shower and she dies in the shower, and they rule it as the medical examiner rules it as death unknown, but there's no medical expert that will actually rise to the point and testify in behalf of the girl, they rule that insufficient proof, there's no one to testify, case dismissed.
Right.
And it's just ridiculous. And you go, wait a minute. We know of what we call witness intimidation, and that is where medical experts who testify on the behalf of petitioners, many of them have been threatened, their jobs have been threatened, their research grants have been threatened. Even medical experts who have testified on behalf of the government and then came forth in a case and said, this one is truly an injury, they're no longer on their being called as a witness anymore, and their jobs are being threatened.
Right.
This is how this game is played, and it's furious, and it's very depressing, but it's also very maddening when you start peeling away the layers of the onion, and you're finding out what's going on, and you pull the sheet away and see who's behind the curtain. It's just a few different players there, and
right.
the people who were injured or who have died.
Right.
Are being denied their justice and compensation for those injuries.
I mean, this is a relatively recent method of compensation. October 1988 is when you said it started. In the part of your book that I read, you said that in the polio vaccine case, there was an episode known as the Qatar incident, where the
right.
Qatar company was producing vaccines that made a lot of people paralyzed, that caused polio.
Right.
And there were other paralysis and other injuries caused by vaccines from other manufacturers. But in those days, you sued the drug company. So why don't we sue the drug companies anymore, or the doctors, or the hospitals, or whoever was involved with the vaccine?
Well, there's two reasons why the current program came to be. One is because of what we call the swine flu fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where the CDC basically sold a bill of goods, a fear scenario, to Congress and to the president, President Ford at the time, and to the American people, that we have a version of swine flu that was very similar to what came out in 1918, the Spanish flu, and killed millions around the world and injured a whole bunch of people, including a whole, you know, a lot, many Americans. But the fact is that after finding out that the swine flu immunization program that was started in 1976 and was halted just a few months later was actually a different strain of flu, and it wasn't the swine flu. But that program, what Congress did was anybody who had an injury, you could sue in state or federal courts, but the federal government would pay for the damages.
Well, if we step back a little further, that started because the insurance companies refused to insure the vaccine, correct?
Well, that was for the DPT vaccine that came. That was also a problem.
I was sure that was for the swine flu vaccine, but anyway, for whatever reason, the government said, if you want to be compensated, we're going to pay, not the drug companies.
That is correct. And then the DPT issue was that what we call product liability insurance companies were refusing to insure vaccine manufacturers of the DPT because of all these lawsuits that were coming up, and it was just dramatically increasing.
Right.
All this built to a point where in 1983, lobbying to Congress to do some type of a program started and ended in November of 1986 when it was signed into law by President Reagan, but it was Henry Waxman out of California that was the chief congressman to push this together. Basically, you have a program where the federal government says all cases must come into must be adjudicated into a specialized court process, and a trust fund would be set up and established to pay for damages. Therefore, immunity was granted to the vaccine manufacturers, but also to all the doctors and nurses and medical practitioners that administered the actual vaccine.
Right, and which sounds kind of like a subsidy to the medical industry, but they don't have to pay for the damage. One of the statistics you had in your book was that, I think for DPT, that some of the court awards were greater than the annual sales of the vaccine.
Yes, because when some of these vaccine manufacturers, the actual DPT vaccine was so cheap to produce.
Right.
Even if you sold 100,000 or 200,000 vaccines, it was so cheap the actual annual revenues weren't there. But the damage that was being done to 10 kids,
right,
required medical attention for the rest of their lives.
Right.
And these court systems were awarding because it takes, you know, $10 million, $20 million, $30 million
right,
to pay for some of these damages for a young child for the rest of their life. And it wasn't, the punitive damages were there, but it was the ongoing medical care that was going to be required for this child. Those expenses are very large.
Yes, they certainly can be, and you can understand that. And one of the things you said was that then what happened was that vaccines got really expensive. But I guess the vaccine companies were saying to the government, look, there's no money in this anymore. If we have to pay out all these claims, we're not going to make any money, so we're just going to stop making vaccines.
That's correct. And so the government reacting to making sure that they had an adequate vaccine supply, you know, they decided to move forward and start creating a national vaccine injury compensation program.
Right. And you've had personal experience. Like in a newspaper article I read, it said that you had a vaccine-injured son.
That's correct. I've got twin boys mm-hmm. who are now 17.
Yeah.
And Austin and Nicholas.
Right.
And at the age of 13 months, both were just typical kids.
Right.
They were born premature, but they were able to get to reach their milestones for the, you know, age 12 months.
Right.
And at the age of 13 months, they received the MMR. And nothing happened to Austin, but to Nicholas, he started regressing. And what would happen for the first 2 to 3 months was a continual crying, high temperatures. He was arching his back. Hardly would eat anything. He would go from constipation to diarrhea, a lot of these things. We didn't know at the time, but a few years later, we figured this thing out, that he was basically suffering from a brain encephalopathy episode. Classic symptoms.
Right. And how long did that last?
We also found out it was too late for us to file a petition in the court because it was statute of limitations.
Right. I mean, it seems obvious, you know, when we're discussing this, and probably now you see it differently, but it would seem obvious that, gee, if you go for a vaccine and then a week later your child starts to behave really strangely, that you would connect the two things. But in actual fact, it's not that common that people will just see this as coming out of the blue.
Well, yeah. It was, matter of fact, it was within, it was the next day that we started noticing some of the symptoms, and we just constant back and forth between the pediatrician's office. They didn't know. They just saw, oh, this is just typical reaction. But this went on for a couple months.
Right.
And it, you know, we were just first-time parents with twins, and we were scared. We didn't know.
Right.
We were just taking the word of the medical practitioner, the pediatrician. Then we noticed within 6 months later, he started losing language.
Right.
And he later regressed severe. Regressed to the point where he was diagnosed with what we call regressive severe, moderate to severe autism.
Right.
And then we've been spending the rest of the time just trying to recover or remove as many symptoms and trying to remove many of the symptoms to recover them from the what we call the iron claws of autism.
Right.
And where they are today at 17.
Yes, and how well have you succeeded?
Oh, we have a very loving child. He's still nonverbal.
Right.
He loves to hum, and he has his singing, but it's nonverbal singing.
Wow.
He had severe gastrointestinal problems that we were able to diagnose many years ago, and he no longer has any of that.
Okay.
We did another scoping, endoscoping, and things like this just recently, and his entire intestinal system and gastrointestinal system, I should say, is perfect according to the doctor.
Okay.
So that was, we did that by diet and supplements and other interventions like that.
Right.
His immune system is very good. He's probably the healthiest of all the family.
Right.
But he still suffers from many symptoms of autism.
Yeah, brain injury is not so easily reversed.
No. We've moved the needle back, maybe to the moderate level. So he communicates with us through a little bit of signing, but he's got an iPad that he uses and other means.
Yeah.
But he's going to be totally dependent on us for the rest of his life.
Yeah, that's a huge burden, and you can understand why, if there was compensation for this kind of case, it would be multiple millions of dollars, because I'm sure you could use somebody to come in every day to help.
We do employ a person to come in every day.
Right, but that's on your
dime. A personal care assistant every day, 40, 45 hours a week.
Right.
to work with him.
Right.
He will not. He does not do well in a school setting because too many kids and, you know, too many noises and stuff like that.
Right.
So
right.
He prospers very well in a home program. So we provide him there. But, you know, my wife and I have major concerns about how to care for him as we get older.
I think that's, you know, everybody with a disabled child,
yep.
as they start to age, must really worry about what's going to happen when we go and they're left alone.
And then, you know, we've had our discussions. Do we burden his brother to provide care, to have to care for him?
Right.
Is it fair for his brother, who has gave up so much of his childhood?
Yes.
Now having to, you know, that's not. So, you know, those are the discussions that many, many families have. Those personal, intimate discussions that you have to have. And that's why I was saying this compensation program is growing, and that's what it's needed to do, to take care of future medical needs. You know, a lot of people have the misconception, those who are, you know, vaccine apologists is what I call them. I said, oh, that's just, they just want to have money so they can go have vacations and all that stuff. The compensation that's awarded does not go to the parents. This compensation, a lot of times, especially, is set up in trusts where it's administered by a trustee, mainly appointed by the court system, to oversee and pay for medical expenses. I mean, these families who have, like, have a child and have other children, they're not going to be compensated for, you know, I know several families who lost their homes because they were just trying to provide care for their child.
Right.
And when they are awarded damages, they can't use the money to buy a home or do any of that issue or,
right.
you know, reimburse for all the emotional distress on the rest of the family. That is not allowed. So while we're denying compensation for these injuries, the burden is shifted towards the taxpayers. That's another part that I started to investigate is how much are the taxpayers paying for this? And it's hundreds of millions of dollars when you look at state and federal funding because of denying compensation that could have been done through the trust fund has now been, you know, transferred to the state taxpayers around the country.
Well, why,
and that's not right either.
Why do you mean that? Because these people end up taking state funds for, like, welfare or...
Right,
know.
Correct. Medical assistance such as Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security Disability.
Right.
Whereas is that if we would compensate them and for their future medical needs, they would not need to use up $250,000 a year in Medicaid expenses for the state of California,
right,
or the state
right.
of New York.
So, which is another, basically another subsidy, hidden subsidy to the drug companies, because every time compensation is denied or people don't file in time, a lot of those costs are going to get picked up by somebody else. I mean, if somebody had a good health insurance program, and I guess that's increasingly rare in the United States, would it cover lifetime expenses for a child like this?
No.
No.
Even with the new Affordable Health Care Act, you know, and what we call Obamacare or Affordable Health Care
right.
Act, there is, you know, you have these lifetime dollar amount caps have been removed. But there are other exemptions, such as how to pay for all the different types of medical services. I have seen some insurance plans step in and provide certain things, but it's very rare. As you said, it's you know, insurance plans are there, but it's not common.
Right.
And matter of fact, there's a lot of insurance plans that will supplement the compensation, but will not be the primary provider. So these insurance companies are trying to step away from this too.
Right.
But mark my words, this is another part of this is that we've been asking Congress to investigate.
Right.
And part of my book, towards the end, I wrote a big chapter on how to reform the program.
Right.
One of the biggest problems that people think is that Congress should look into this. Well, here's one of the big roadblocks to that. This program is basically tort reform. So you have the political ideology discussions now of whether or not to work on tort reform.
Right. So for people who aren't Americans, who aren't really clued in about this, my understanding is that defense lawyers tend to be Democrats, and they want to have lots of lawsuits in courts with big money settlements, and the Republicans are saying, no, we don't want this. That's crazy to get, you know, $10 million for spilling a cup of coffee on you or something. But in cases like this, the reality is that tort reform would result in less money going to victims.
Well, that's the whole idea behind tort reform.
Right.
And I am a pretty conservative person,
right,
who is absolutely against tort reform.
Right.
I've seen through the smoke and mirrors of tort reform. Now, here's why you also have, this program is here to stay, is that you have other industries. The pharmaceutical industry outside of vaccines, such as the pill industry, wants the same protections.
Right.
People just have to go back to Vioxx.
Right.
And see how much money Merck had to pay out for damages.
Right.
Think about all the medical device companies. They want the same protections. They don't have that. Think about all the manufacturing and construction industries. How many times do you see on TV ads for, if you worked in an oil refinery or you worked in these mines
or
you worked,
right,
in these industries, you might, you know, if you develop certain types of cancers or lung disease or whatever, you might be eligible for settlement.
Right.
That's why you have the tort reform issue. You also have other industries pressuring Congress, and it doesn't matter what party you are, they're both being pressured we want the same protections.
Were you really saying that this program is kind of a dry run for tort reform, that this is what the legal system would look like if we had tort reform?
Well, before 1986, excuse me, there really wasn't much of a tort reform measure,
right,
to the size that it is today, what you see the vaccine court. You saw, you know, efforts in the states to try to pass tort reform in the late 90s and the last decade, in the 2000s, you saw a big push, okay? This is probably a template for our federal government to move forward and indemnify other industries. And that's why, even though, there's people that will call to repeal the program, that will never happen. To reform the program, yes, we could reform it, but not the major problems. But I think there is agreement to reform certain parts, such as the statute of limitations.
Right. You have a good list of the ways the court could be improved.
The death benefit is unbelievable, too, that it's not even been indexed against rising inflation. So $250 back then is today. I think it's just under just over $5,000, $500,000 in today's dollars.
Right.
But if you file a death petition seeking compensation, that doesn't mean you get $250,000. You still have to prove it, and the government might come back and say, we're going to give you $200, or we're going to give you $100.
Right.
And they're going to lowball you. And this happens all the time.
Right. How has your view on vaccines changed since the experience with your son?
Well, at first I was a very big proponent of vaccines. But ever since I started researching, and my wife led the effort. She was the one that, she quit her job to start researching vaccine injury for our son. We were living in Oklahoma at the time and had no other resources. I've come to the point, and it's just, I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm pro-safety and a choice of families can make themselves. I will protect the right for someone to get a vaccine as much as I will protect the right for someone to refuse a vaccine.
Right, and it's becoming more and more difficult to refuse vaccines nowadays. I mean, there's healthcare workers who are forced to go home or lose their job if they don't get the flu vaccine.
Right.
And getting into school without vaccines is a minefield. It's very difficult. And so whether, people, you know, sometimes have had religious exemptions, but I don't know if there's a scientific exemption. Like, I've done my research, and I don't want to get any vaccines, or I don't want to get this particular vaccine. Like, you know, something like hepatitis B, which is supposed to protect you against a disease that usually occurs in, like, drug addicts or highly promiscuous people. Like, when my child is young, why would I give it to
right.
them at that point? If, you know, maybe later it would make sense, but some of these,
you know, you're correct. That's the way it is. I'm weighing these options. We haven't vaccinated our kids or our family ever since we figured out that Nicholas was vaccine injured many years ago. Okay.
Right.
Now, I am trying to understand and figure out this meningitis vaccine.
Right.
Because I think that could be a threat. But I'm wondering if there's alternative medicines, options for teenagers, instead of just having the vaccine to help bolster the immune system to fight against a meningitis.
When my kids were teenagers and they were talking about the meningitis vaccine, I wrote to the government and I said, I want to know what evidence that you have that this vaccine actually protects people against meningitis. And the information they sent me was shocking. It showed one graph of, you know, somewhere in Africa where they'd been trialing the meningitis vaccine, and there was a meningitis epidemic. They gave the vaccine, the number of cases went up. Then they went down, then they gave a second vaccine, and they went up again or something. But it was the kind of thing that you could interpret for or against the vaccine. It was definitely not a clear way of saying this worked or did not work. It was not like there were two cities, and one they gave the vaccine and one they didn't, and you could see the difference. It was not a placebo-controlled trial. It was really shockingly lacking in any kind of scientific rigor. When I looked at that, and I thought, there's no way that
right.
I would take the risk based on this. If you can't prove to me that the vaccine's effective, you're expecting me to trust that it's safe. How irrational do you think I am?
Well, there's actually kind of a movement that I'm aware of trying to add a fourth exemption to on a state level or on a federal level. It's called an educational exemption.
Yes.
That is, I'm college educated and I can read and I can understand and I just refuse to give vaccines. I think it's more of a tongue in cheek type of approach, but it does come point to the view that parents can read and understand both sides of it and make a logical and rational decision. And yet the medical community says no.
Well, I mean, normally with medicine, we're supposed to have informed consent, and to me that would mean that you have the right to refuse any medical procedure, and if you're a parent you have the right to refuse it on behalf of your children. That would seem right.
Right.
I mean, I can see that there's cases, you know, like Jehovah's Witnesses that refuse blood transfusions, and there might be a child that might die, although often, usually it's because the child's been having chemotherapy, and it's not really that they needed the blood until the doctors persuaded the parents to have chemotherapy. But, I mean, there probably are cases where the state needs to intervene, but basically the state is intervening on every school-age child now by saying you must vaccinate unless you meet this narrow set of exemptions.
Recently, there in the news, there was about a court case over in Italy, and it was decided a year and a half ago, but it was actually the compensation part came out, and it was interesting is that they have a certain vaccine that's not licensed in the United States, but it's a real beast. It's called a Inforex Hexa. It's basically six or eight vaccines all rolled into one.
Right.
And they showed conclusion with medical testimony and their court system, they're allowed to do what they call discovery, showed documents from GlaxoSmithKline, a 1,200-page document showing that in their clinical trial data, they experienced several kids who developed autism, okay? They awarded this child money compensation for their needs, what we found out was really interesting was in the United States, a lot of the clinical trial data that's used and submitted to the FDA for approval is also hidden from the public domain. Legally, they're allowed not to disclose a lot of this information. They've worked at the Congress enough over and over and the federal agencies where they're not required to disclose certain information.
So in episode 36 of my show, I interviewed a doctor from Oregon, Eric Turner, who used to work at the FDA, and what he says is that information is available on the FDA website, although it's not very easy to find. But are you saying there's some information that's actually completely kept secret?
That's correct, because we asked a few attorneys who represent petitioners and said, we can't get we've been looking for information on autism, information on other clinical trial data for Gardasil, from Merck, from Gardasil, and we've been unable to get that type of information because it's legally cannot be introduced into a U.S. court system. And so it's kind of shocking, but yet we don't know exactly everything, but it's just the preliminary discovery and discussion of it leads to the working hypothesis or working theories, if you will, that does in the United States, are there clinical trial data or other information that the public does not have access to? Now, we had a previous guest that says it's on the FDA website. I would venture to say that it's quite possible that a lot of, several attorneys who were very good at looking for this type of information have been unable to find it.
Well, you should, I'll send you some information about Eric Turner's work. I mean, he basically said that all the clinical trial data is available, but it's not easy to find, but some people like him know how to find it. But there may be exemptions, like maybe vaccines are actually, the information is kept secret. But it's an area you should probably look into more, because if that information is available, even if it's hard to get a hold of, it can't be that difficult to get it.
Well, but if it's designed to be very vague and difficult to find out, that might be construed in some type of a court system as the public having the inability to have access to it. the general public, and therefore is informed consent.
Right, you know, right. Well, there was a case that you documented. I think this was going back to DPT or polio or something where the nurse injected somebody and then later claimed that she had read the label for the vaccine but had not mentioned any of the adverse events to the patient.
Right.
But, I mean, I look at it like they may as well give up on vaccination, because I think if they read, you know, before each time somebody was vaccinated, they said these are the possible side effects of this vaccine, I think a significant majority of people would not get vaccinated. They're just ignorant of the possibility.
Well, there is a federal requirement, what we call the Vaccine Information Statement, the VIS statement, must be handed to the legal guardian of children or to adults prior to them receiving vaccination. And the idea was is that for them, for people to read that and ask questions before they're getting vaccinated. Well, the problem is there's no teeth to that law, and most of those statements, one, are given to the parents as they're leaving the clinic with three screaming kids, and they're not going to have time to read it, nor will they read it later.
And is this after they've been vaccinated?
Well, yes, and that's where we have seen many cases, but they're required to give it to them prior to vaccination.
Well, it's kind of useless afterwards, isn't it?
Well, that's correct, but there's nothing in the statute to penalize these doctors or nurses for not complying, giving the patient or their legal guardian time to read prior. And no penalties have been enforced. Now, the issue is that the vaccine information statement is maintained by the CDC. The CDC has a representative on what we call the Advisory Council for Childhood Vaccines to the Secretary of HHS. There's an advisory council called the ACCV, right. And CDC has a representative that sits on this council. And they meet quarterly, and these meetings are open to the public. Generally, they're telephone conference calls.
Right.
But they do talk about the VIS statements. And they've really watered these things down to where not all the major injuries are emphasized. A sore spot at the site of injection, or maybe a fever, or a real quick feeble seizure episode that's not lasting, or things like this.
Right.
With
a lot of drugs, they have a very detailed multi-page pamphlet that's supposed to go to the doctor, I guess. And then there is a much simplified document that might go to the patient if the patient's lucky, and I assume it's something like that. And then if
right.
you order down what goes to the recipient of the vaccine, then everything's sweetness and light. It's just a few minor inconveniences. It's going to be the only thing you might expect.
Right, and, you know, patients, well, what we're finding is that patients or parents that actually are starting to take control of healthcare decisions,
right,
are asking for package inserts,
right,
and that's where you're seeing a big resistance. And doctors are saying, you know, I'm the expert. Let me tell you what's going to happen,
right.
And the parents are going, wait a minute, no. And I know many, many parents who have walked away, packed up their bag at their kids, and walked out. Said sorry.
Yes. I mean, what is, what would you suggest that parents do? Maybe they can find, there are a few doctors who don't recommend vaccines. So if parents are concerned about vaccines, even if they just want to pick and choose the ones they feel are necessary, they don't really see measles as a big deal, they don't really see hepatitis B as all that important, but they're willing to accept other vaccines, I mean, what's their best way to move forward?
Interview their doctor.
Yeah.
Their doctor is going to work for them. They don't work for the doctor.
Right.
If, you know, my wife and I, when we moved to Minneapolis 4.5 years ago, we shopped around for pediatricians.
Right.
For our kids. And we were not shy at saying, we have a vaccine-injured son. We do not vaccinate.
Right.
Do you have problems with that? They said, yes, we won't allow you into the clinic. We said, fine, we move on.
Right.
But we, you know, you approach other disability groups in your areas and you ask around. And we've got the pediatrician that we have now, which we really enjoy, does vaccinate for those who parents that want to receive a vaccination for the children.
Right.
But absolutely respects and says, no, I will not pressure you to vaccinate your child.
Yes, yes.
You know, you got to retain your rights, you want to take control of your life and your family's medical lives, you've got to put your foot forward and do some things. Otherwise, you just succumb to whatever is given you, and you're out of control. You do no longer have control of your the medical outcome for your family.
Yes. We're coming towards the end of our hour, and it's been a really really good discussion. I've enjoyed talking to you, and I think the information you've brought forward is really important. The name of your book is The Vaccine Court, and thevaccinecourt.com is the website. And can people purchase the book today?
Yeah, it's been out since November.
Okay.
You can purchase it many different outlets, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble online. There's certain health impact group has it. You can go to skyhorseoneword.com. That's the publisher.
Right.
They have a link to go buying it. You can go onto the website and look for the books link, and then it'll lead you to Amazon or to Barnes & Noble.
Okay. Sounds like if people go to your website, they won't have any trouble finding it. And if they have a favorite bookstore, they can online, or a real bookstore, they can probably get it that way as well. So I'd just like to thank you very much for joining me today, and I greatly appreciate the information that you've shared. Any last comments before we depart?
I just thank you very much for what you're doing and allowing me to come onto your program and talk to you and your listeners.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I'd like to give a shout-out to my listeners. Thank you very much for continuing to listen to the show. Please tell your friends about this. Lots of excellent interviews like this, and I think we can all learn a lot. And if people do have suggestions for future guests, please let me know. And goodbye for now.